Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, July 14, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today we'll be discussing the new book, Disinherited: How Washington is Betraying America's Young. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording the call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome today author and senior fellow of the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research, Diana Furtgott-Roth. She'll be joined by the Honorable Eileen O'Connor. She's a partner at Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman right here in Washington, D.C., and also chairman of the Administrative Law Practice Group Executive Committee of the Federalist Society. We're going to proceed essentially in an interview format, but I believe to begin with, Eileen O'Connor is going to further introduce our author guest. So with that, Ms. O'Connor, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. Thank you so much. And thank you, Diana, for joining us. For those of you who aren't sitting at your computer and don't have Diana's biography in front of you, I want to just touch upon a couple of the high spots of Diana's very impressive resume. The first thing I want to mention, which is not on here, is that it's been my pleasure to have Diana as a friend for a number of years. Her professional accomplishments are so impressive. She was chief economist at the United States Department of Labor under Secretary Chao. She's director of Economics 21, which is a wonderful project. I get daily emails of the news from Project Economics 21. And as Dean said, she's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research. You can also read her regular writings because she's an editor of RealClearMarkets.com, a columnist for the Washington Examiner, MarketWatch.com, and my favorite, Tax Notes. From 2001 to 2002, Diana served as Chief of Staff to President George W. Bush's Council of Economic Advisors. She served as Deputy Executive Director of the Domestic Policy Council and Associate Director of the Office of Policy Planning in the White House under President George H.W. Bush from 1991 to 1993. Diana's book is, as Dean said, Disinherited: How Washington is Betraying America's Young. As the grandmother of four young grandsons, the title of the book definitely drew my attention, and I wanted to know more. This was a phenomenon that I had seen happening, but what Diana very often manages to do is to gather together all the data that has been in the periphery of your attention and puts it together in a way that helps you understand what is happening, and better yet, has prescribed solutions to the problems that we're facing as a result of government policies. Diana's written some wonderful summaries of her book that have been published in the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal piece was written as a commencement address, but of course, as a conservative, Diana's not invited to give commencement addresses. But it's the sort of thing that young college graduates really do need to hear, and they will be very, very benefited if they read this book and act upon it. With that, Diana, will you please tell the audience about your book?
Thank you so much, Lee, and thank you so much, Dean, and thank all of you who are listening. It is such a pleasure to be speaking to you today, and I'm looking forward to your questions. My book, Disinherited: How Washington is Betraying America's Young, is co-authored with a millennial, Jarrett Meyer, and we interviewed many millennials to illustrate the fundamental unfairness of our government policy, which is systematically biased against younger people and in favor of older people. We're expecting young people to pay off our debt and our deficits. We give them a worse deal in terms of education. When they come to get into the labor market, we make it more difficult by putting up artificial barriers that keep them out. Plus, we even expect them to pay higher premiums for health care so we can pay lower ones. So I'm just going to touch on a few of these issues, and then I can expand more in the question and answer period. Well, young Americans today are having trouble finding employment, and they're dropping out of the labor force, leading to delayed life milestones. 6 years into the economic recovery, the unemployment rate for young people ages 20 to 24, almost 10%, is over twice the unemployment rate for those 25 years and older, which is about 4%. The teen unemployment rate is 18%, and the rate for African American teens is 32%. The share of teens and young people employed or looking for work, which is known as the labor force participation rate, is at the lowest level since the government began keeping records on this in 1948. Plus, from 1968 to 2007, the percentage of 18 to 31-year-olds living with their parents held steady at around 32%, but by 2012, that number had increased to 36%. Among young people 18 to 24 years old, 56% lived at home in 2012, a historic high. Well, America is in fiscal trouble, and young people are being asked to shoulder the burden, a burden they did not place on themselves. We are putting money on the nation's credit card. We're not paying it off, and we're asking them to pay it. As many of you know, America is $18 trillion in debt, and states are $5 trillion in debt from unfunded pension liabilities. Paying off the federal fiscal gap would require an immediate increase of 57% in all federal taxes, or cuts of 37% in all federal spending except interest payments. Social Security and Medicare account for almost 40% of the federal spending in 2014, but we don't find that politicians are trying to fix Social Security and Medicare. Fixing Social Security isn't very difficult. Changing the indexing from wage indexing, that's indexing the benefits to all wages in the economy, to price indexing, indexing the benefits to prices in the economy, as well as gradually raising the retirement age, would go a long way towards fixing the program. It would bring it into balance. When Social Security and Medicare were put in place, average life expectancy was 67 years. Many people didn't collect benefits. Neither FDR, who died at 63, nor LBJ, who died at 64, collected benefits from these programs that they put in place. Now, it's fortunate that people live until their mid-80s or even 90 routinely. It's no surprise to see that in the obituary columns. But we need to fix the programs. We need to recalibrate them so as not to be unfair to America's young. If trends continue without the suggestions that I just proposed, the combined employer-employee payroll tax would have to rise from 15% as it is now to 32% in 2050 just to cover Medicare and Social Security. We think that that's impossible. How could anyone have a payroll tax of 32%? But it's routine for countries in Europe. We don't want to get to be Europe. Well, the fight against young people starts much earlier than Social Security. In fact, it starts in primary and secondary education. In America, only 80% of high school students graduate in 4 years, a share that declines to 65% among African Americans. We are favoring old over young in the way that we run our schools. We keep on unqualified teachers due to union rules, even though it means that children get a worse education. Economic studies show that replacing a teacher in the bottom 5% with a teacher of just average quality would generate an extra $250,000 in lifetime earnings for a 28-person classroom. In New York and Chicago, barely one in 1,000 teachers is fired for poor performance, and there are rubber rooms in New York City where they keep some of these teachers who they cannot manage to fire. In Los Angeles, fewer than 2% of teachers are denied tenure. and only 25% of teachers who received tenure were fired over the course of our decade. We need to move to more school choice the way Governor Sandoval has done in Nevada, so that parents have a better choice of where to send their children. If we look at some charter schools, such as Success Academy Harlem, 86% of the students are proficient in reading and 94% are proficient in math. Going on to college, young people are graduating with an average of $27,000 in debt and few opportunities to pay it off. 70% of students graduate with debt. The number of student loan borrowers owing between $50,000 and $75,000 has doubled since 2004, and the number of those owning more than $200,000 has tripled. College tuition has increased by over 1,000% since records began in 1978, while food costs have only risen by 240% over the same period. It's really unfortunate that this government has taken over the student loan program, and governments lend as much as possible, as much as people ask for student loans. It's possible to get loans of $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, even if a student is majoring in something which will not lead to a job. That needs to be changed. The government needs to get out of the student loan business. There have been examples of new companies such as Upstart and Pave, which are funding students based on how much they think they will earn afterwards. They fund the student's education, and they're repaid with a percentage of income afterwards. Plus, there's community colleges that only cost $3,000 a year and that can lead to high-return professions, such as in the healthcare professions, occupational physical therapy, occupational therapy, radiation assistant, nursing assistant. All these are high-paying careers, and yet there's a stigma towards going to a two-year college. You might be able to take those credits afterwards and get a four-year degree at a fraction of the cost, about 50% of the cost of a traditional four-year degree. But high school counselors still don't advise young people to apply to community college. That needs to change so that young people aren't stuck with an immense burden of debt going forward. Well, once young people graduate from college and then they head in the workforce, you might think that we would make it easier for them to get jobs. But no, there are bureaucratic rules that protect established businesses, and they close off many avenues for entrepreneurship and employment among young people. One-third of occupations require a government license or certification, and nearly 40% of U.S. workers will need to get some government permission to work at some point in their lives. In contrast, fewer than 5% of the workforce needed a license in the early 1950s. These tend to be state regulations, so tour guides in college-heavy cities such as Charleston, South Carolina, Savannah, and New Orleans must gain certification before the government allows them to earn money by walking and talking. Two rights clearly protected by the U.S. Constitution. No one ever died from unmatched drapes and an unmatched rug, yet interior designers need licenses in many states. Frequently, licenses to cut hair for cosmetology take even longer than emergency medical technician licenses. Everyone knows that for health and safety, certain professions, such as EMT, and doctors and nurses need to be licensed. But many of these other professions, such as tree trimmers, don't need to be licensed. But the battle against the young starts even earlier. It starts when they're teens, when minimum wage laws prevent teens from getting into the labor market. If you're a teen, good luck this summer getting a job in San Francisco or Seattle, where the minimum wage is $15 an hour. Even a minimum wage of $7.25 an hour keeps out some young people. It's morally wrong to say that if you have skills under $8 an hour or $10 an hour or $15 an hour. Just pick your local living wage limit. You are not allowed to get a job. You're not allowed to work in the United States or in your particular state if it has a higher than federal minimum wage. And keeping teens and low-skilled people out of the labor market has effects far into the future. They don't learn basic work ethic practices such as coming to work on time, staying the whole day even if it's boring, and being nice to an unpleasant boss and even less pleasant customers. These are all skills that help them later on when they enter the job market. Plus, our government makes it difficult for these unemployed young people to get unpaid internships in for-profit companies, internships which can lead to a better job later on. We tell the story in our book, and we have many stories in our book, but one of the most poignant stories is Sammy Page, who last summer was offered a job by a recording company. He's a philosophy major, but he wants to have a band, and his school wouldn't give him academic credit for the unpaid internship, so he had to turn it down and spent his summer playing his violin and guitar on the streets of New York City. It's really astounding that you can get an unpaid internship at the White House, in Congress, for the AFL-CIO, for a community activist organization such as New York Communities for Change, but not at a recording studio or an entertainment company such as Fox, because the Labor Department has said that it is discouraging unpaid internships in for-profit companies. It put out a set of regulations in 2010, and the Assistant Secretary specifically said that this was aimed at unpaid internships in for-profit companies. Well, to make it worse, when young people do go into the labor market and they have to pay health care premiums, under the Affordable Care Act, their health care premiums have to be higher so that the health care premiums of older people can be lower. Again, our government is systematically biased against young people, and the Affordable Care Act is another example. It used to be that young people aged, say, 20 to 24, people in their 20s, paid premiums that were about one-sixth the amount of older people. But under the Affordable Care Act, the premiums have to be in a 3-to-1 band. You cannot charge one person more than three times the amount of another. That's why young people's premiums have to go up so that older people can pay lower ones. What that means is that young people are paying more for health care than they have to be paying. They also have to buy a plan that is overly generous. Even if they have no children, their plan on the exchange has to include pediatric dental care, maternity care. If they have no drug problems, it still has to include drug abuse treatment. If they have no mental problems, it still has to include mental health treatment. So what we need to do is, as well as reframe the premiums, we need to see if we can change the law so that exchanges are allowed to sell smaller plans, catastrophic health plans that are smaller and aimed more at emergency situations. Well, just to conclude, a country that betrays its young cannot fully prosper. The future of America can be saved, but our government has to cease its betrayal of youth. Congress should vote on every dollar spent in every year rather than having entitlements grow every year on automatic pilot. It should adjust Social Security and Medicare programs to keep them in balance as people live longer and get more benefits. Schools should be changed to make it easier to fire teachers. And the government needs to get out of the student loan business. The regulations preventing young people from working should be dismantled. We need to look at government policy through the lens of how it affects young people's ability to work, as well as how it affects women and minorities. We hear a lot of emphasis on what is a particular law doing to minorities. What is it doing to women? We hear very little emphasis on what is it doing to young people, and that needs to change. And with that, I'm very happy to take your questions. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you, Diana. That was an excellent summary. And there are, as you mentioned, there are so many stories relating to the experiences of just certain people. One of the things you just said really struck home with me. I remember noticing many years ago, you said young people are delaying life's milestones. And this goes back 25 years. I remember a young man I worked with, and his wife was also a professional. They were very well on their way to success. They were making nice incomes, but they were postponing having children because they wanted to have a nest egg. And being in the tax field, I of course can't help but notice how much they were paying in taxes, and thinking that if they weren't paying so much in taxes to cover things that the government is charging us all for, the government shouldn't be doing at all, they would be able to get along with life's milestones. It's just such a shame. Another one of the things you mentioned is that, and I like the way you put it, that America is putting this great big debt on its credit card and expecting that the young people at some point are going to pay it off. One of the things that I don't think is written enough about is the fact that America is engaging in long-term borrowing for short-term expenses. You can't go out and get a mortgage to go out and have a nice dinner. You can go out and get a mortgage in order to have a house that you're going to live in and that it's going to last. But our young people are being asked to pay bills for things that have already been long gone and long spent. You mentioned the student loan costs, and you didn't quite get to the fact of the government taking over, but you did mention that the cost of college has risen substantially, and one of the reasons is because of the federal subsidies for it, and the fact that the government has now also taken over the student loan business. You mentioned licensing. We had a teleforum last year on Clark Neely's book, Terms of Engagement, which also talked about the licensing issues that that people face when they want to go into businesses that really shouldn't require that strict licensing. I really liked your expression that nobody died from unmatched drapes and carpet. And finally, about the young people, it just seems to me that government policies these days are turning the concept of family on its head in so many ways. In the early part of the last century, people depended on their children to take care of them in their old age. It was sort of the family contract. I take care of you when you're a little kid, and when I get to be old, you'll take care of me. My son often, whenever I have done something for him, he'll just say thank you from the bottom of his heart, and I will tell him, don't thank me now. Take care of me when I'm old. And that was the lovely contract that we used to have with our families. And just finally, and we'll turn it over. We'll give you the opportunity to respond to some of these points I made. I really appreciate your expressing that it is morally wrong to say that if what you are going to contribute to a business, the business owner doesn't consider to be cost effective at $15 an hour, that you aren't entitled to a job at all. That is just so well said. And you're mentioning that the high cost of premiums, and the fact that although Obama said if you like your plan you can keep your plan, it was always in the law that Obamacare rendered illegal every single health insurance policy in the country, because before Obamacare we could buy the coverage we needed, and a 65-year-old woman didn't have to buy insurance that would cover prenatal care if she delivered a baby early, because the chances of that happening were zero. But similarly, an unmarried 22-year-old man has to have a policy for that. So it's just it's a very bad situation, and I really appreciate the way you have lined it up to help young people understand that, whereas everybody always wonders how is this going to affect this minority or that minority or women or whatever, they don't stop to look at how it's going to affect young people, and young people are picture of our country. And, you know, I was going to ask you a few questions, but I found myself just sort of commenting on your comments and your book instead. But are there any things that you would like to say in response to those comments before we open the floor?
Sure. Well, thanks for those excellent comments, Lee. Well, life milestones since 2000, marriage rates and fertility rates are declining. And that makes it even harder to pay off the federal and state debt, and also to pay for the entitlement program. So we really need to make changes in this area to increase economic growth, to make sure that young people are in a better position so that they are not delaying having children and getting married because of their economic situation. And if I could just explain a little more about the minimum wage point. It's not simply that they're not entitled to a job if the minimum wage is higher, but employers aren't going to hire them. We have many stories in the book, one of them from Linda Mack, who has a bicycle store in Silver Spring, Maryland. Linda Mack's political views are somewhat to the left of Barack Obama's, but she has an internship program for young people that paid $7.25 an hour when the minimum before Maryland and Montgomery County raised its wage. She said she couldn't have her paid internship program for teens if the minimum wage was going up to $11 or $12 an hour the way it is supposed to do in Montgomery County, because she can't be training people at that wage. And so raising the wage means that these paid internship programs will disappear. It means that when an employer has a choice between a high-skilled person and a low-skilled person, he will hire the high-skilled person. You can't expect to be paid and hired at a $15 an hour wage if you only have $7 an hour skills. So thanks very much for those comments, and I'm happy to field any other questions.
Dean, will you open the floor, please?
Sure. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Once again, let me repeat the name of the book. It's Disinherited, How Washington is Betraying America's Young. Remind you that if you got a notice of today's call, the link to that book is in the notice of today's call, so it's easily available. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question at this point, so let's go to our first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. You presented an excellent litany of ways in which government is dysfunctional, but it's not just betraying the young, it's betraying everyone, even its employees and dependents. And obviously the result of all this is going to be a situation like we see in Greece today. But we won't have anybody to bail us out then. So we're headed toward a fall. There probably is no way to avoid it, but there may be ways to mitigate it. When I was a kid in school, many, many years ago, we learned, partly as part of our high school program, things like how to be a good citizen, how to participate in a jury, how to appear as a witness, how to choose and elect a candidate for public office, how to make government do what you want them to do. So by the time that we graduated, we knew how to participate in making government work for us. And kids don't learn that today. And on a sad note, I remember a conversation I had with some young people after I'd been substitute teaching them. And I discovered that they were drug dealers right there in public school, along with all the other kids, looking like any other kid. And I asked them how they felt about drug dealing. And they said, we hate it, but with all the rules and regulations, we have no other way to make money. So we turned to drug dealing and other illegal or underground activities as a way to meet our needs. And I said, I asked them, do you realize that sometimes leads to violence and death? He says, yeah, well, I just hope it doesn't happen to me.
That is so sad. I'm so sorry to hear that story. And you're absolutely right that everyone is worse off because of our government policies. But in a sense, these young people are the worst off because they are already, they're out of the labor market and trying to get in it. Whereas people who are older before the Great Recession, many of them have jobs already. And they have those jobs once you're into the system. Once you have a job, it's easy to keep one and then keep going. So I think that the labor market restrictions hurt people who are out of the labor market. There are some older people out of the labor market who want to come back in, but I think it's primarily young people. With the schools and favoring unqualified teachers over the others, there's a plethora of union rules that make it very difficult for public schools to get rid of these teachers. And I think that young people are particularly hurt. The kids in these schools are hurt. And the same with the college loans, the fact that the federal government has taken over the student loan system. They will lend as much as people ask for as long as you fill out the right forms. And without any kind of looking over the person's shoulder to see, will the person graduate from college? Will they be able to pay off the loan with the major that they've chosen? Will they be able to get a job? And again, that particularly affects young people. Also, the health insurance rules, the rules that young people have to pay higher premiums because of the 3-to-1 band. In many of these ways, I think older people are getting away with more. They're having less economic damage, but they are still very concerned about what's happening to their children and, if they have them, their grandchildren. They're not happy with the situation either. A publisher wanted to call the book Disinherited, How the Boomers Are Robbing America's Young. But it's not really that the boomers are doing this. Many of them don't like the situation at all either. They want their kids to move out. They want their kids to have good jobs. It's really these politicians who are crafting these rules in place that don't allow young people to progress.
We've got a couple questions pending at this point. If you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call now.
Yeah, this is Jeff Kimball. I'm a lawyer in private practice in West Virginia, and I blog at thelibertychronicle.com. I apologize. I missed the initial your initial comments. I got on the line just a little bit late, but I'm very involved locally with the Compact for America movement to try to hopefully at some point gain some success in getting an Article 5 convention for purposes of achieving a balanced budget amendment. And I didn't, as I said, I didn't hear your initial comments. I was wondering whether you had any thoughts on the ability of a balanced budget amendment to achieve, you know, any part of the relief that is needed here. I know one of the things that we say is that the debt right now, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of about $58,000 for every citizen and about $155,000 for every taxpayer, and we say that it's the ultimate form of taxation without representation, that we're running up this, constantly running up higher and higher, this deficit, this debt on the backs of our children, who will ultimately be responsible to pay it in one way or the other, either actually paying it through taxes or through a much lower standard of living as a result of the depleted dollar. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes. I do think that a balanced budget amendment would be helpful if it could be passed. But it has to be structured in a particular way. It's difficult to structure a balanced budget amendment because by the time the government has got the revenue for a particular year, they have already had to pass the budget for the following year. So right now we are in fiscal 2015, our government is working on the budget for fiscal 2016 that's going to start October 1st. But we do not have the revenue in, we don't even have the revenue in for calendar year 2014, let alone calendar year 2015. So it would have to be carefully crafted so that it was some percentage of revenue raised 2 years ago, or the revenue raised 2 years ago plus, you know, 0.2 of a percentage point or 2%, whatever the economic growth was. The problem is our Congress is so much out of control. I would not normally, in normal circumstances, be in favor of a balanced budget amendment, because under ideal circumstances, Congress would be able to manage its own affairs, but it does not seem to be able to do it. It just seems to be addicted to spending and incapable of passing any laws that constrain itself. In the book, we do suggest that Congress be required to vote on every dollar every year. Right now, a substantial percentage of the budget, about 60 or 70%, just goes through on autopilot. Well, how about saying, rather than a balanced budget amendment, that Congress has to vote on every dollar spent, no more entitlements, everything has to be voted every year. I mean, that would go one step towards preventing all the spending. Urban Institute scholar Eugene Sterley wrote a book called Dead Men Ruling, showing what percent of the budget was put in place, was spent by rules and laws passed by people who aren't even alive now. So this is a major problem. There needs to be major budget reform, and if Congress can't manage to do anything better, then a balanced budget amendment, I think, would be the way to go.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We still have two questions pending, so let's take another call now.
Yes, hi, this is Grant Herron. I'm an attorney in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and I also missed the first part of the comment. So if this is something that's been addressed, by all means, just let me know and move on. But I was wondering, regarding the efforts in Congress right now to kind of revamp the student loans, I was kind of wondering just what all is going on with that. Just kind of heard a good deal about it, but nothing ever seems to get done. But I just am interested. Obviously, I have a lot of student loans myself, so it is of interest to me. And also, there had been an ABA article a while back that spoke of how the student loan bill had been folded into the Obamacare bill, and I believe used to offset some of the costs or something along those lines. So I was just kind of wondering what a revamp to student loans would then do to the Obamacare stuff. Thank you.
Yes, well, your memory is correct. The student loan bill was passed in order to give enough money for the Affordable Care Act to go through and keep the total package under $1 trillion. There are efforts to revamp student loans on Capitol Hill, and some people say student loans should be forgiven. There's a bill that says that students should only have to start paying their loans when they're working. That would be a good initial step, because right now the student graduates, the payments are due right away. Seems like prolonging it to when the student gets a job would prevent a lot of defaults. There's other bills that would do something to waive some of the payments. This is basically the next bubble waiting to burst, and I think we need to tackle it fundamentally where it is. And this is something that I think is ripe to be moved over to the private sector, despite whatever budget consequences it has, because a lot of the payments that are due to come in to be on the government's balance sheet for student loans are obviously not going to materialize due to defaults. And the private sector would do a better job of gauging who to lend money to and would ratchet down some of the amounts. What I was saying earlier is that there's practically no cap on how much students and parents can borrow under the loans now. And so universities just send their tuition higher and higher and higher because they know the students are just going to borrow from the federal government, and whatever they charge is going to get paid. So we need to get off that moving escalator.
We have just one caller pending, and then our lines will be open. Push the star button and then the pound button if you'd like to ask a question of our expert today. Before we move along, this is Dean. Let me ask a follow-up question on the student lending in particular. Do you do any comparison in your book? First of all, I'm wondering how your arguments, how your critique of the student loan system have been received. But then I was wondering whether you compare it to the critique by the federal government of private lenders in various forms. The federal government, the CFPB in particular, is very critical of payday lending because of the unfair terms, the unfair repayment terms in particular. But the federal government's also been extracting settlements in the hundreds of billions of dollars from the mortgage industry precisely because it made loans, they allege, that the borrowers were not going to be in a position to repay.
It strikes
me as pretty hypocritical, and it seems that the way you're describing the federal government's student loan programming, they're a big bad actor.
Yes, it's very interesting that under Dodd-Frank, in order to for a bank to lend a mortgage, give a mortgage, they have to make sure that the lender, the borrower, can actually repay, which is why former Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke famously was not able to refinance his home after he left the Fed, because under the paperwork he couldn't prove that he was going to have enough income in order to be able to repay the new mortgage. Yet on the other hand, the federal government lends as much as people want without looking at what their major is, whether it's engineering or sociology, whether it's a high return field or a field where there is too many people. And law, for example, is one of those fields where there are a lot of unemployed attorneys these days, and yet they still lend for going to law school. But as far as payday lending goes, the government has ratcheted up controls on credit cards. Whereas someone used to be able to put money on a credit card, it's harder to get the credit card now. So they go to these payday lending areas, and they don't want to go to them. It's just a last resort. People do occasionally have desperate needs for money, and by clamping down on the credit card companies and having them turn away people because of their credit records, they drive individuals towards these payday lenders. Now they say they're going to get rid of the payday lenders, but the solution would be to have better thought out regulations on credit to begin with, rather than clamping down on these other things that pop up. And I can assure you, I don't know very much about the future, but if they clamp down on payday lending, there's going to be other groups that come out to try to lend at very high rates just to answer that demand for when people do need to borrow.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending. Let's head in that direction now.
This is David Applegate with the Chicago Lawyers Chapter. I'm a 62-year-old lawyer, and I don't think I'm being too off base in saying that we seem to be in the grip of a great national madness at the moment, in which we believe that we can, and in fact largely have, repealed the laws of biology, economics, and the constitutional rule of law itself. Whatever is trendy and offers immediate gratification seems to be not only condoned but mandatory, and that includes a college education. But my question, not having read the speaker's book, is whether the speaker is aware of a precedent for this suggestion that students have their education financed, whether it's by employers or someone else, and then pay back a percentage of their income over their lifetime or some other period of time. Because that was actually tried in the 1970s, at least by certain Ivy League institutions. It was called tuition postponement option. And any number of my classmates opted into it, only to start shrieking and complaining as soon as they got good jobs and found out that they were paying more than they expected. There was a general revolt against that. I don't know how that actually played out with the institutions that made them the offer. But again, as I said, not having read your book, I'm wondering if you're aware of this precedent and have any further thoughts on the feasibility of that proposal.
We actually propose it for the private sector. On page 77 of our book, we discuss Upstart and Pave, which are private lenders who provide a technological platform that allows those with available money to invest in young people and their careers. And with lenders such as Upstart and Pave, investors are repaid through percentages of borrowers' monthly salaries for a period of up to 10 years. So to determine the individual rates, companies, rather than the federal government, calculate likely future earnings based on university major grades and professional experience. And they charge between 4 and 7% of income. That enables investors to make informed decisions. And it also enables students to take advantage of this without having to go for federal loans. This is repaid over 10 years. It's completely voluntary, so I wouldn't see that there would be any protests about it. Because borrowers are free to choose any major or career after receiving the loan. And if the borrower, if the income of the borrower falls below 150% of the poverty line, he's allowed to defer repayment. And Upstart borrowers do not owe anything if they make less than $20,000 a year, but the repayment period can be extended. So we discussed the private sector equivalent of what you were mentioning.
Again, if you'd like to start a conversation, I was just going to say, Lee, our lines are wide open. Push the star button and the pound button if you have a question. Otherwise, let's revert to you, Lee O'Connor.
Thank you, Dean. So Upstart and Pave are existing lenders. Is that right, Diana?
Right, exactly, yes. That's
and
right.
Why would somebody go to them? It sounds as though they've got more sensible terms than the government does. Why would somebody go to them with the government right there just practically giving it away?
Oh, because they pay about 4 to 7% of their income, and it's due in 10 years, over 10 years. So after 10 years, you know that you don't owe anything else, and it's a certain percentage.
So it's a better deal. It's a better
right,
deal
exactly.
than the government.
Right.
Okay, so it's forgiven.
Right, exactly.
You don't have to default. It'll be forgiven
right.
if you don't manage to
right,
give
but,
it.
Right, but then Pave and Upstart pick individuals based on universities and majors who they think will be able to repay the investment. So
mm-hmm.
if they think that, for example, the university isn't good enough or the choice of major is not very lucrative or the SATs aren't good enough, then they won't invest in that particular individual. So it's not as though they take everybody. And part
right.
of the problem with federal student loans is that they just take everybody, they lend them as much as they want, then they're stuck after they graduate paying it off, or even if they don't graduate, they're stuck paying it off. So you have individuals who have dropped out of college and who still owe tens of thousands of dollars with very little ability to pay.
I have two questions for you, which are kind of a bookend. The first is, and I wanted to ask you this earlier, but I didn't want to take up callers' time. What was your inspiration? What prompted you to write this book? What got you and Jared started on this?
Well, I wrote a column called The War on Youth, and one of my friends, Professor Fred Summers, an emeritus professor at Brandeis University, wrote to me and said, Diana, this is a very important subject. You should turn it into a book. And by the way, Diana, you need a co-author because your writing is too data-driven and too boring. So Fred Summers, a very, very eminent philosopher and the husband of Christina Hoff Summers. Yes, the scholar
Excellent.
At the American Enterprise Institute. Where I always followed his advice because he was such a wise person. Unfortunately, he died last October. He saw drafts of the book, but he didn't get to see it finished. He was the one who saw my column and said, Diana, this should really be a book and you need a co-author.
Well, God bless him for giving you that advice and you for following it. And about your co-author, is he now going to start an American Association of Young People?
Well, he's working very hard at it. He was in Las Vegas at Freedom Fest promoting the book. He's going to the Midwest, Chicago, where his family's from, and speaking speaking about the book. And he's very, very enthusiastic, very dynamic, and the book would not have been written without him.
I have another question or two, Dean, but you wanted to ask one yourself.
Yeah, we do have one audience member question. Maybe we should go back to the audience.
Take for sure.
Hold on 1 second.
John Rowland, Constitution.org, once again. You might consider what the prospects would be for confronting the issue head on and simply having a movement to demand that all regulations and license requirements be removed from people below a certain age.
Yes.
So that somebody could open a lemonade stand and not have a cop come by and shut them down because they don't have a license as a street vendor. So if you simply exempted them, even from, let's say we go up to the level, anyone on a student loan gets exempted or some other such cutoff, even for things like having a bar cart, let the kids practice law. That could start to change things real fast.
Yes, yes. Well, New Zealand exempted all its federal occupational licensing requirements. It actually took the step of allowing the individual professions to determine it, but it got the government completely out of the business. Of course, if the individual groups or associations determine it, then they might also have an incentive to keep people out. But yes, there's far too many of these regulations, and one even reads about children's lemonade stands being closed down. Here are young entrepreneurs who want to start being entrepreneurial at an early age, and some state official comes and closes down their lemonade stand. It's absolutely outrageous.
Again, if you have a question, we've got a few minutes left. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. I think, that, Lee, the question I was going to ask really went to the ready availability of student loan money and the increases in tuition costs.
Mm-hmm.
Is that just a correlation, or do you talk about in the book of some real causation there in terms of studies?
We talk about it in terms of causation in the following way, that universities find that they can charge whatever they like, and the federal government will lend the students money to pay that amount of tuition. And that's why tuition has been one of the fastest growing goods over the past 15 to 20 years. So we can see that college tuition has increased by over 1,000% since records began in 1978. While food costs have only risen by 240% over the same period. We can see that universities are becoming more and more lavish in terms of the offerings in their dining halls, the gyms, the dorms. They're becoming like luxury clubs. They don't need all of that. And they don't care about just improving the facilities, hiring more administrators, passing the costs on to students.
Administrators. I just wanted to drop a footnote here. You mentioned administrators, Diana. I've read absolutely shocking numbers about the increasing number of administrators over the period of time that you mentioned, that their populations in colleges and universities have absolutely skyrocketed.
Yeah, that's right. They have skyrocketed, whereas the number of professors have stayed about equal.
Did you find in your research that, especially in bad economic times when unemployment is high, that people shift their efforts to college with the readily available money? It seems like a good option at the time.
Yes, you find a lot more people going back to school when the unemployment rate is high, both in terms of professional schools and actually regular schools, undergraduate education. And what we need to do is try to move people to a more simple option, such as community college, and try and take away the stigma, because having a four-year degree becomes something that's socially necessary rather than professionally necessary. We interview a number of young people in our book, and Some of them have told us that if they had known how much with the amount of debt they would end up with, they would not have incurred those college loans, and they would have gone some less expensive route.
It does seem as though a cost-benefit analysis is something that is not encouraged when young people are thinking about whether and, if so, where to go to college. Is that right, Diana?
That's right. I mean, certainly from the point of view of the federal student loans, there's no cost-benefit analysis done. With the private sector groups, Upstart and Stay and Pave, they do choose who they invest in, because they have their money on the line. But as all of us know, when the federal government only has taxpayers' money on the line, they don't worry about how much it costs.
Right.
I'm wondering if you've heard about these blended programs that kind of take advantage of the low-cost community college. They have that program in Virginia where if you, graduating from high school, go to a two-year community college, get a degree, and maintain a certain grade point average, then the state schools, which are quite good in Virginia, have an agreement to take you after that period. You do 2 years at the state school and graduate with a degree from UVA or William & Mary or George Mason. Are you a fan of those programs as sort of a compromise? Or?
Yes, I'm a very big fan of those programs, and many states have them. Florida also has those programs. That if you go to community college for 2 years and you have a good grade point average, you can transfer to a state university, and then you have a college education at about half the price that you would have otherwise. You could also, of course, choose to leave with the community college degree and go on to get a job in an area such as one of the healthcare professions, physical therapy, occupational therapy, or one of the computer science fields, which are very lucrative in terms of software design or computer programming, that kind of thing.
And you mentioned that a lot of students come out of, on the back end of school, with more debt than they thought they were going to have. My observation, well, I've got two kids in college right now, it gets easier to budget the further you get into the college program. But the first year and the second year even, the amount of money you pay doesn't seem to be accurately reflected in the amount of money advertised by the college. Now, do you find that's the case, that they give you a total, quote-unquote, figure that ends up being maybe 80% of what you actually pay to put a kid in a first year and second year of college? Is there some dishonesty there, or what's happening that kids come out with more debt than they expected?
It's very difficult to gauge the absolute amount because there's not only the tuition, but there's also living expenses, and those can vary. So I guess with any other kind of loan, it's difficult to pick the exact amount. And also, you're not always certain about what the interest rate will be when you graduate, so that's also difficult.
Right. Interesting. Well, we don't have any more questions from the audience, Lee, but we do have a couple minutes for any final thoughts, I suppose, or concluding remarks.
Yes, I would like to reserve those for Diana. Would you please?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank all of you for listening, and then I want you to encourage any young people to get together and lobby Washington and get out there and make their voices heard. One problem is that there's an American Association of Retired Persons. There's no American Association of Young Persons. Young people need to make themselves heard by calling their congressmen, calling their senators, taking part in political movements and trying to bring some sense to Washington, understanding that they are at the disadvantage for spending. All the spending is going to rebound on them, and that also that they do have the power to do something about it.
Well, a final time, the title of the book, Disinherited, How Washington is Betraying America's Young. On behalf of the Federal Society, let me thank our author and our interviewer, our questioner. Thank you both. We certainly appreciate you spending the hour with us. To the audience, a reminder to check our website and monitor your emails for upcoming Teleforum conference calls. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dean. Thank you, Diana.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.